This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Marianne Zalesnik filling in for Lucy May. Coming up a little later in the program, a group of Kentucky students is suing the state, saying it's failed its constitutional obligation to provide an adequate and equitable education. And Cincinnati sues a major landlord. But first, we'll talk about some breaking news that just came out within the hour, and it is related to First Energy. And here to talk about it, Ohio Public Media Statehouse News Bureau Chief Karen Kassler. Hi, Karen.
Hi, how are you?
Good. So I'm sort of just reading what you're sending us as we go here. I'm just going to ask you to start. What happened today?
Well, we have a federal indictment from federal court in Cincinnati on two First Energy former executives. They've already been charged in state court, but these are federal charges. This is former First Energy CEO Chuck Jones and former Senior Vice President of External Affairs Michael Dowling. They are accused in the federal indictment, as they were accused in the state court indictment, of bribing state officials to pass the $1 billion nuclear power plant bailout that was known as House Bill 6, and also to keep it from going to the ballot so voters could potentially repeal it. And so this is, again, the first federal charges for these two. You might recall that former House Speaker Larry Householder, who's one of the two individuals that the indictment specifically names that Chuck Jones and Michael Dowling bribed, it was already in court on trial in Cincinnati. Of course, I'm talking about former House Speaker Larry Householder. He's serving 20 years in prison for his role in the scheme. And so now we have these federal charges for the two former First Energy executives.
All right. And you'll have more on that later today that we'll have in our afternoon news during All Things Considered and on our website.
Yeah. And I think it's really important to note here that we're about to have a change of administrations, and maybe that could have had something to do with this. I just think that's the timing of this is really interesting as we're going into inauguration day on Monday.
And as you said, you had no idea this was coming, right?
Yeah, this was our big thing, which I think we're about to talk about,
right,
was the U.S. Senate appointment that we were waiting on. So this was kind of an interesting thing to have develop right away.
All right. Well, moving on to what we were originally going to talk about, now that we have at least shared what we do know or what you know about this First Energy case, we do have an open U.S. Senate seat in Ohio, and Governor Mike DeWine has to appoint someone to fill the seat. It was left vacant when J.D. Vance resigned to become vice president. Now, many have expressed interest. Vivek Ramaswamy took his name off the list. Now he says he wants to put it back on, and longtime U.S. Senate Democrat Sherrod Brown, who was defeated in the fall election by Republican Bernie Moreno, also has recently talked about his time in office. And so here to talk about both those things, Karen Kassler, who we've already heard from, and State House News Bureau reporter, producer Joe Ingles. Hey, Joe.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Thank you for being here. All right. So I guess what we need to say first is that Governor DeWine has scheduled a media availability this afternoon, I believe is the way it's listed, Karen.
Yes. Yes.
Is that a signal of, yeah, I'm going to tell you who I'm appointing?
Yeah, I think that's pretty clear because we've been waiting on this. And again, the timing is really interesting because we are going into Inauguration Day on Monday. J.D. Vance had resigned his Senate seat back on January. It was about a week ago. And so DeWine had said he was waiting for Vance to resign before he announced his appointment. But you mentioned Vivek Ramaswamy. He kind of got into this a little bit late here because Lieutenant Governor John Husted was always seen as the front runner, at least the most likely front runner. And yet Ramaswamy kind of came back into the conversation after a meeting with DeWine about the job and reports of some pressure from President-elect Trump on whether he should run, whether he should be part of the Senate. Trump had already appointed him to head this Department of Government Efficiency alongside Elon Musk. So it was interesting when Ramaswamy had taken himself out of consideration, suddenly he was back in. But I think I can safely confirm that it's going to be Lieutenant Governor John Husted.
Oh, really? Okay. So you think that Ramaswamy is going to be back to DOGE?
Yes, or wherever he ends up going. I wouldn't be surprised at all if Ramaswamy expresses an interest in governor. because that's where Husted was going to go. He was going to run for governor in 2026. And we already have Attorney General Dave Yost, who said he wants to run as well. But it would not surprise me at all for Ramaswamy to decide to get into the governor's race, since he's not going to be in the U.S. Senate. And the DOGE appointment, if it does continue, would allow him to do that, because DOGE would end in July of 2026. And so that's right as the campaign really gets going there.
Well, you know, it's interesting, though, because Husted has said all along that he has wanted to run for governor. I mean, he's been running for governor for the past 2 years, it seems. Not officially, but certainly it's the actions he's taken indicate that. Is this a big switch for him to change and suddenly decide, yeah, I'd rather be in the U.S. Senate?
Well, obviously, a U.S. Senate seat is a rare opportunity. There's only two from Ohio, and you only get those opportunities once in a while because they're six-year terms, and it takes an awful lot to run and win a U.S. Senate race in Ohio. As Sherrod Brown found out this last time around, he raised and spent more money than Bernie Moreno, and Bernie Moreno ended up beating him. But this is a rare opportunity in that sense. Senators tend to last a while in office, so I think this is unique for him, but it doesn't preclude him from running for governor eventually. I mean, Mike DeWine himself was a U.S. senator and has been governor for the past two terms. So if Houston's got a lot of time here, but this is an interesting opportunity for him to go and replace J.D. Vance. And I think, you know, we certainly didn't know a couple years ago that J.D. Vance was going to be the vice president-elect, that Trump was going to pick him for his team, and that they were going to win. So I think Husted was looking at his future and deciding governors where he wanted to go.
It's interesting. There were several other people that were interested in the seat. And some people thought it might be possible that Jane Timken could get appointed, because then she'd be the first woman U.S. senator from Ohio.
Yeah, I think that was an early guess. I mean, everybody was interested in this on the Republican side. Again, a Republican or a Senate appointment is a rare opportunity. And so you had all sorts of folks who were expressing an interest and getting other allies behind them. DeWine kind of ruled out last month that he would be considering one of Ohio's 10 Republican congressmen. He said that he was narrow margin for Republicans in the U.S. House was a factor in his decisions. That seemed to suggest that those 10 Republicans were out of consideration. But there were lots of other Republicans who had expressed an interest. I think his phone was ringing off the hook.
It's interesting to note also that when DeWine has to make this appointment, he wants to pick somebody who can get reelected, correct?
Oh, that he said that was one of the qualifications. He wanted somebody who could not only win a general election, but also win a primary. And that's a key thing here. I mean, we've had several people who have run for Senate in the last couple of years. I mean, there was a 7-person field in 2022 when Vance won. It was a 3-person field last year when Bernie Moreno ran, and that's just on the Republican side. So there were a lot of folks who had wanted to run. Matt Dolan, a state senator from Northeast Ohio, was one of those. He ran in both those races, but he did not win either primary. And so the primary is really important here, because you do have Republicans who will be more than willing to go up against one another because of the opportunity that a Senate seat provides.
Well, let's talk about the governor making this appointment. This is common. And how long is it for? Will Husted have to run? Does he fill out the entire term? How does that work?
There's a special election in 2026 when Husted would have to run to keep that seat. Obviously, it's up to him whether he would decide to do that. But I think it's pretty expected that he would. And then he would have to run again in 2028 for the full 6-year term for the seat. Since Vance was elected in 2022, the 6-year term expires in 2028. So it's another thing DeWine said. This is a person who has to win those races, who has to work for those races. And so this is somebody who's going to have to be well known to Ohioans potentially, and somebody who's going to be able to raise a lot of money, because Senate races are very, very expensive to run anywhere, but especially in Ohio.
Well, we're going to talk, hear more about that as well this afternoon. Karen's going to be very busy, because you'll be at that news conference or that media availability with the governor coming up in about 45 minutes. So we'll have details
actually
on that coming up. Yeah.
My colleague, Joe Engels, on the line here. She will be
upstairs
with the governor.
That's right. You're busy with First Energy. Well, Joe, let's talk about our former or soon to be former senator from Ohio, Sherrod Brown. tell me a little bit. He is former. Tell me about, you had a chance to talk with him. What is his mood right now? How does he feel about not being in public life for the first time in decades and decades?
Yeah, the first week of January, Sherrod Brown's successor, Bernie Moreno, was sworn into the office. And so Sherrod Brown, for the first time in generations, basically has become an ordinary citizen for right now. And so I kind of asked him, you know, how does that feel? And it's obvious to me, Marianne, that he sees a political future somehow. And he wasn't telling me that he's going to run for the seat, you know, that Vance has just vacated in 2 years. He didn't say that, but he didn't say he wouldn't. And we kind of see that he is positioning himself with his message to be able to go out to Ohioans and make the case for why they should elect him and put Democrats back in control of some parts of government.
Do you think there's any chance he'd run for governor?
Well, you know, he could. He really could, except that Amy Acton is someone that has always been supportive of Sherrod Brown. Sherrod Brown has always been supportive of Amy Acton. You know, she's been recently, we've seen her involved in Democratic politics. She went to the Democratic National Convention, for example.
We should just clarify who that she is. Dr. Amy Acton was came to
former
prominence
Ohio
during
Health Director.
Right.
Yes, she's a former Ohio Health Director. And people who are listening, if you remember COVID and the white coat doctor that got up in the early age of COVID, you know, the first year of it, Amy Acton was the doctor who would get up and give those real common sense kind of explanations about COVID and COVID spread, that sort of thing. She has taken a pretty low profile in politics since she left that position. She's worked with some foundations. She was rumored as a candidate who might get into the Senate race when Tim Ryan jumped in a couple of years ago. So now she's in the race. She's announced that she is running to be the senator in 2026. You know, Sherrod Brown and Amy Acton, they, you know, like I said, there's a tie there. And I would have thought that they would have probably talked about that ahead of time. So I feel like Sherrod Brown, the things he says he wants to do would be best accomplished at the federal level. He had some legislation at the federal level that he had to leave on the table. And he was talking about how he would like to see that across the finish line, get it, you know, see someone take it across the finish line. That's what makes me think he might be leaning toward going into the Senate versus going into the governor's office in 2026.
What did he say he was most proud of in his time in office?
Well, he has said he's very proud of the worker gains that he has made, the gains for workers. And most recently, you remember on his way, basically his last night, one of his last votes was for this elimination of the windfall elimination provision, the GPO, that it's a thing that's associated with Social Security. And I'm going to try to explain this real simply. Public employees in Ohio, like your teachers, your firefighters, your school clerks, your school cafe workers, they're all considered public employees and they pay into public pensions. And previously, they have been docked serious money from their pension or from Social Security, and they have not been able to collect all of the money they've earned in Social Security. And you remember that maybe they've had other jobs, you know, during the course of your lifetime, you don't have just one job. So the money that they've paid into Social Security has been docked, or the money they pay in their pension has been docked because of this provision that's been in the Social Security system. So this Social Security Fairness Act that they just passed, it was one of the last things that Sherrod Brown did when he was on his way out the door. And basically, it gets rid of this provision that takes money away from public retirees who earned Social Security money so that they can get their money just like someone else who paid into a different kind of pension plan.
We're almost out of time. We have a little bit left, but tell me anything else that came out of your conversation with Sherrod Brown that you'd like to share?
Yeah, he said, he really thinks that Ohio Democrats need to be focusing back on workers in Ohio. You know, Sherrod Brown has always been a big proponent of labor in Ohio, and unions have always backed him strongly. And he says that, you know, the Democrats need to get back in that game. They need to remember that these are the people that they want to fight for. And he said, you know, sometimes there's a coast mentality, East Coast, West Coast, and that's what, you know, gets filtered down to the electorate. And he said that needs to stop in Ohio, that in Ohio, it needs to be about workers.
You also reached out to the new senator in Ohio, Bernie Moreno, and what happened?
Well, I haven't heard back from his office yet. I have been contacting him through his press people every few days. I, you know, keep asking for a sit-down interview of some sort with him, and I haven't gotten that yet, but I hope to get that at some point in the future. And when I do it, I will make that available to everyone, too.
All right. Well, we have all kinds of news coming out later today. We'll wait for that coming up in the next maybe several weeks. And of course, the latest on the first energy situation that Karen was talking about and finding out officially who Ohio's next U.S. senator will be. It's a busy Friday. Thank you both so much for being here today.
Thank you, Marianne.
Great to talk to you. Happy weekend.
You too. I've been talking with Ohio Public Media Statehouse News Bureau Chief Karen Kassler and reporter-producer Joe Ingles. In just a moment, why a group of Kentucky students are suing the state. This is Cincinnati Edition. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Marianne Zalesnik filling in for Lucy May. Later in the program, we'll talk about the city of Cincinnati suing a major landlord, plus evictions are up from pre-pandemic levels. First, a group of Kentucky students associated with the Kentucky Student Voices team is suing the state, saying it's failed its constitutional obligation to provide an adequate and equitable education. Alongside a dozen named students from across the state, the organization alleges state funding has failed to keep up with inflation and has led to renewed disparities between property poor and wealthy districts. Here to help us sort through it all, Capitol reporter for Kentucky Public Radio, Sylvia Goodman. Hi, Sylvia.
Glad to be here.
And Kentucky Lantern reporter McKenna Horsley. Hi, McKenna.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Thanks, both of you, for joining me today. Let's talk about what this is all about. Sylvia, can you explain why this group is suing?
Sure. So it kind of all goes back to this 1989 court decision that was really massive for Kentucky. It was called the Rose Decision. And essentially, this organization sued the state and said that you are not upholding the state constitution, which requires that you provide an efficient school system. They alleged that the state needed to put more money in, that there was disparities between urban and rural areas, that certain parts of the state weren't getting enough money, and that that needed a court to rule that it was unconstitutional to prompt change from the legislature. And they won, and the legislature then put in place several major reforms to the state, most notably the CARA is the name of the act. And it put in place all sorts of important things. One of the most important is the SEEK formula. There's so many acronyms right now. I apologize.
So we should say CARA is Kentucky Educational Reform Act, right? Reform Act, right.
Exactly. And then they put in place this formula that decided how money would be distributed across the state. It's a very complicated formula that is still used today that determines how much each school district gets from the state funding. And essentially what this lawsuit does is it harkens back to that initial court decision and says, since that was put in place, the reforms that happened have slipped backwards and are no longer effective in making sure our school districts are adequate and equitable. And therefore, we need the courts to once again rule that Kentucky's education system is unconstitutional and that the lawmakers need to go back to the drawing board.
McKenna, anything you want to add to that or anything else you've observed with this?
Yeah, there are several things in this 70-page complaint, but essentially The students are citing issues that they see currently within their own school districts, and often gave testimony about their own experience in schools and education. Some of the main issues, though, that they highlighted were a declining lack of or a declining rates of literacy skills, a lack of civics education in their schools, reported mental health crises, and the limited availability of arts programs and severe academic disparities among school districts.
And is this complaint I know came from a group of students? Are they from all over the state or particular parts of the state?
Yes, they're from all over the state. The Kentucky Student Voice Team, it works to get students kind of in policy making and keep them in this process. It's a spinoff of the Pritchard Committee for Academic Excellence, which is a statewide group that organized in the 1980s, particularly ahead of that original lawsuit that we were talking about. So this is something that's been in the works for a long time, but it's putting students at the forefront of this to give their own experiences and opinions on education in Kentucky.
Thanks, McKenna. Sylvia, tell us a little bit about what they're actually asking for. They're pointing out that there's been this slide back and since the Rose decision, but what are they asking for in the lawsuit?
So as of right now, we don't really know what's going to come out of the lawsuit, even if the courts did rule in favor of the students. That's because what they're asking for is a declaratory judgment. They're asking for the Supreme Court to declare that the school system is unconstitutional. They're not laying out specific policies they hope will come out of that decision. It'll essentially, if the Supreme Court did decide or the courts did decide to make this judgment, it would then be kicked over to lawmakers to decide what they would do. That being said, across the country, there have been a few different iterations of a similar type of lawsuit where, asking for these types of judgments. And a frequent conclusion is that the state needs to put more money into the system. Like I mentioned before, one of the big reforms that came out of the original Rose decision was the SEEK formula. So, for example, it could lead to some changes in how that formula works and how money is distributed across the state. And it, for example, might require that portions of that formula need to be funded to a greater extent, may need to be fully funded if they're not currently fully funded. So it could lead to all sorts of things, additional accountability measures that the legislature needs to be put in place, things like that. But we don't know exactly what could come out of this. It's not specifically laid out in this lawsuit, and I think that's intentional. And another thing that I think is worth noting is that this Rose decision, according to lawyers on this case, they have a lawyer from here in Kentucky, but they also have people on the case from Columbia and Harvard University's programs who have come to Kentucky, and they're saying that this initial Rose decision was actually a really important national precedent for education law, for how you can force lawmakers to take action on education. And they're saying that they believe that this lawsuit can once again be a precedent, that you can renew these same calls that you made maybe two or three decades ago for lawmakers to take action. You can renew those efforts every time you feel that once again, the state is not upholding its end of the bargain.
Well, you said the court could rule that in favor, and it would get sent back to the lawmakers. But aren't the lawmakers named in the suit?
They are named in the suit. So essentially, they're suing the lawmakers to force them into action. So Senate President Robert Stivers and House Speaker David Osborne are named. So is the Education Department Commissioner Robbie Fletcher, who's recently appointed. So they're basically naming the elements of the state government that they believe should be taking action to rectify the issues within our education system.
McKenna, let's talk a little bit about the possibility of this becoming, we talked, Sylvia mentioned the whole idea of it, the Rose case being considered nationally. Is this something that's happening in other states? And do you see that this is the start of this sort of bubble up again, that education is not being funded properly, is certainly different in rich and poor districts, and that's going to bubble across the country if this goes anywhere?
Right. Well, I think that this is part of a long-standing conversation that we've had in Kentucky, particularly about education within political discussions. The two lawyers that Sylvia mentioned from Harvard and Columbia both said that they wanted to be a part of this lawsuit because of that Rose decision and the impact that it ultimately had on national education. Here in Kentucky, though, over the past few election cycles, education has been at the forefront of campaigns, both on the Republican and Democratic side. Current Governor Andy Beshear, a Democrat, when he campaigned for his first term in 2019, he really courted the teacher vote in the work of public education. And that's something that he's continued throughout his time in office. And then also on the other side, we're seeing Republicans critique schools, as we saw with last year's Amendment 2, which would have allowed the General Assembly to fund non-public schools. However, Kentucky voters did vote down that amendment. And so I think what we're seeing is kind of a combination of different steps here in Kentucky to prompt this lawsuit from students.
And I just want to really quick, oh, sorry.
No, go right ahead.
Add here that I think it's important to note that Republicans have also noted that they think there are some severe issues within the education system. But the disagreement is how to fix it. Democrats have long argued that we need to put more money into the public school system, whether that be through teacher raises, which they say they're long overdue for universal raises, or through different they need to fully fund transportation, things like that. Whereas Republicans say we need to stop funding a failing system and instead look at what's underlying that. For example, they calling for more accountability measures, things like that. Or, for example, like McKenna pointed out, school choice, which is not currently on the table because of the failure of that amendment last year. So there is like an agreement that something needs to happen in education. But so far, we haven't seen any, at least no systemic or really large scale changes.
Well, if it is sent back to the legislature and the court says fix this, and you have these different ways of looking at it, how do you determine what the best way to fix it is? Do the lawmakers just pick?
Go ahead, McKenna.
Go ahead. Kind of looking back to that Rose decision, it prompted, once the Supreme Court weighed in, of course, it did take some time to get to that level. We saw changes within a year and work on that CURA Act between both Republicans and Democrats. The legislature at that time, of course, was mostly in the hands of Democrats and the executive branch as well. So I think we'll see a lot of discussions. They won't be quick discussions, but there'll be a lot of debate about what to do among politicians in Kentucky.
And I also think it's important to note that in that Rose decision, right, it did throw it back to the legislature, but the Supreme Court listed certain things that they thought made up an adequate education, right? Like they listed, for example, you know, needs to have basic understanding of government, things like that. There's all these requirements that they have. So once again, the Supreme Court could list the things that they think are missing from the current education system that need to be included. One of the things we mentioned before, adequate and equitable. So it might also require certain levels of equitability between how different districts are funded. Something like that could happen, and the courts could weigh in on what needs to happen. It's just up to the legislature to really put that into law, because as we know, it's really complicated, you know, beyond just saying something needs to happen, making sure it actually gets into the law and trickles down to the school districts.
We have to wrap up, but just, McKenna, maybe you know, how soon do you think we'll hear from the courts? How long will they take to act on something like this? Any idea?
It will probably take a long time. I think that both sides probably do expect this to go to the Supreme Court level. I would be very surprised if it was just decided at the county circuit level. One of the lawyers for the Student Voice team did say that while they are seeking an expedited review on this case, they don't think that any decisions made in court will impact the current legislative session that's underway right now. So it will probably definitely be a future conversation.
All right. Well, we're going to have you both back and talk about it when that happens. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
Thanks.
I've been talking with Kentucky Public Radio Capitol reporter Sylvia Goodman and Kentucky Lantern reporter McKenna Horsley. In just a moment, we'll talk about why Cincinnati is suing a major landlord and evictions are up from pre-pandemic levels. This is Cincinnati Edition. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Marianne Zalesnik filling in for Lucy May. The city of Cincinnati has filed a lawsuit in the Hamilton County Court of Common Pleas this month alleging property owner Vision and Beyond is potentially leaving hundreds of Cincinnati tenants and local investors in limbo. Here to explain what this means for both the tenants and the investors is WVXU long-form reporter Nick Swartzel. Hey, Nick.
Hey, Marianne. How are you?
Good. Also, eviction filings in Hamilton County last year were higher than the average before the COVID pandemic. That's according to new data from the Eviction Lab at Princeton University. And WVXU local government reporter Becca Costello is here to talk about that report. Hey, Becca.
Hello.
All right, we're going to start first talking about Nick's story with a company called Vision and Beyond. Who is Vision and Beyond?
So Vision and Beyond is a company that basically recruits investors or did recruit investors to invest in residential property in Cincinnati, but also in other cities like Columbus, Lexington, some places in Texas as well. And they get these investors together. They buy properties, small apartment buildings, big apartment buildings, single family homes even, and rent them out. And then the investors get the profits from those rents. That's the plan, at least.
That's been going on for a while.
2018, I believe, is when they started here in Cincinnati.
And now there are lawsuits against Vision and Beyond.
Yes, there are at least six different legal actions currently in play in the Hamilton County Common Pleas Court. It's pretty complex. The most recent filing, a legal action, was by the city of Cincinnati seeking a receivership for a large number, about 70 of the properties Vision and Beyond owns.
And, tell us what a receivership is.
Exactly. So a receiver is an entity, a property management group that can help with maintenance and problems at a property if the owner is not doing their job to do that. Cincinnati has done this in the past, called in a receiver for other sort of like large apartment complexes and things like that where the owner isn't doing necessary maintenance to keep it up to code and make it safe for tenants. So the city is doing that because they claim in their filing that Vision and Beyond has abandoned these properties. They're not doing maintenance on them. And when you pull the thread further, that's because those properties are currently in foreclosure proceedings based on the fact that Vision and Beyond owes, you know, millions of dollars to these creditors that they took out mortgages on the properties with.
So they're not paying their bills, basically.
Basically, yeah. So that is where things stand right now. There has been a receiver appointed for some of the properties, maybe most of the properties. Some of them, it's still kind of unclear who is taking care of the properties, but the city really wants to get that worked out. The financial institutions that are also kind of like filing foreclosure proceedings, they also want receivers appointed and have had receivers appointed for some of these properties to make sure they're being taken care of while this all gets worked out. It's a really complex legal
who
situation.
Who pays for the receivers?
That kind of depends. Usually it'll end up being the entity that owns the property. Like they'll go after that person or that entity to, make things right in the end after all the legal proceedings have settled down. In the meantime, it comes out of whatever pocket is pursuing the legal proceedings. So
you've had a chance to go to some of these buildings and talk to some of the tenants. Tell us what they're saying. What is it like to live in these properties right now?
Yeah, so I spoke to one person who lives in a property right next to Vision and Beyond's current or former office, depending on kind of what's going on. It's unclear. And he said that he's not super impressed with the maintenance he's been seeing at the property. He's been there like 4 years now, 3 or 4 years. And basically he's saying like, I would call, they'd say, yeah, we'll send somebody out. And then that person wouldn't show up or they wouldn't do a good enough job and it would just be a problem again. And he's retired. He says, I know some of this, how to do some of this. So he was starting to do it himself for his own property and for his neighbor's properties too, because he just said, people aren't showing up. When I went to visit him at his property, there was a lot of siding missing from the property. It was not in great shape. It didn't look like it was falling apart, but obviously there were some things that needed addressed.
Is he the only one you talked to, or did you talk to anybody else?
I went to a couple other of the larger apartment complexes that are named in some of these legal filings, and I did hear from people that they had problems with their heat, where they weren't able to figure out who to call to get their heat turned back on in the winter, some problems with plumbing, and some other issues. I also noticed maybe things weren't plowed at all in some of these complexes.
So from the
people
snow.
People were having a hard time getting in and out. Trash piled up, that kind of thing. Just generally doesn't seem like people are taking care of the property.
You also mentioned that they're having trouble. They don't know who to pay the rent to.
That's right. Because the way this happened was so quick, when it first went down, people would go to take their rent checks and the office would be like, oh, you have to make it out to somebody else now because this company no longer is taking care of these properties. Here's who you need to make it out to. Or they just didn't know where to send the check at all. Like, you know, this is not working. There's nobody to answer my calls. Like, what's happening here?
So they've just disappeared?
That's unclear. A couple of the court filings from the city and from the creditors suggest, and from the investors who are also suing, suggest that the two founders or three founders may have fled the country. But, whether that's true or not, it remains to be seen. I think there will be further legal proceedings and we'll find out.
And you talked to an attorney?
I talked to a couple of different attorneys. I talked to an attorney who works for Vision and Beyond, does some work for them, and he said he would pass along our request for comment, and he, I haven't heard back yet, so.
Yeah. And do you anticipate you will at this point, or?
That remains to be seen, yeah.
And same thing with the city. The city didn't want to talk about this either, right?
Well, the city did get back to us, and they said, you know, because the sort of proceedings are ongoing. They don't want to comment. They did say, they let me know that all of these cases are being kind of consolidated into one case, and there will be one judge for that one case. So that's going to make it a lot easier to kind of follow in the future. So things are happening, things are moving, but it's, you know, pretty complicated.
And there are also some other issues involved with the mortgages, right? Some falsifications. Can you explain what that's about?
This is where it gets pretty confusing, and I would definitely direct people to WVXU.org to find the story online, because you really got to
read
this.
I read it twice to try to get through it all.
So these groups of investors would form little holding companies for their property. Then the allegation is that Vision and Beyond took those holding companies and transferred the property out of them into a different holding company that only Vision and Beyond could control, if that makes sense.
So instead of being part of this bigger group, it got moved to a smaller group.
Right, right. Okay. The investors no longer had control over the property on paper, basically. The investors
did they know that?
They did not know that.
They did not know that.
And so that's the allegation, at least. Then Vision and Beyond used those properties to get mortgages that the investors didn't know about. And those are the mortgages that are being foreclosed upon right now. So the mortgage company is like, well, who owns this property? Because the paperwork says multiple things. The investors are like, hey, this is ours. We had no idea that it got moved into this other category. We had no idea these mortgages were happening. So that's a big legal
mess.
And
do you have any idea who these investors are? Is that public, or is it all just labeled as Vision and Beyond?
So the investors are mostly folks from Cincinnati, but there are some folks from other places. Some of them are listed in some of the lawsuits because they're filing the lawsuits. I spoke to an attorney who represents one of them, and he was kind of talking about their interest and what's going on and like sort of what's going on from their point of view. So yeah, we know some of these folks, but there are probably dozens of them. I will say, when I spoke to the person who lived next to the offices while we were talking, an investor for the property next door who had been, you know, he claims defrauded, came up and was like kind of looking at the condition of the property. And he was, you know, him and his partner were just like heartbroken, like saying they stole our money, basically. So
there's all kinds of people that are going after Vision and Beyond, for a better way.
There are multiple lawsuits alleging this, you know, this.
And you said it's going to get put into all in one court case. Do you have any idea when that'll actually get action on it?
I think that remains to be seen. I know that there is a hearing scheduled for late February. Whether something happens before then or not, I will be keeping an eye on.
All right. Well, thank you. You broke that story, and we're certainly happy to learn about it, at least to be able to be aware of it. It's out there and going on.
Yeah. And I want to credit Becca, because she's the one that found out about it first and let me know when she was working on the story she's going to talk about, I think.
All right. Well, thank you, Nick. And again, WVXU.org, if you want to see Nick's story, which will explain it. You can like read it twice there, which is what I had to do to keep up with it all. Becca, let's talk about evictions. You have some new statistics that have come out. What did you find out this week?
Yeah, it's a less complicated story, but certainly important. So there's a group, the Eviction Lab at Princeton University, is really the only group that I'm aware of that's tracking eviction cases nationwide. And so their information was updated through December, so having the full year of 2024 as well as the month of December. And one of the things they found is that evictions in 2024 in Hamilton County are now 6% higher than the previous average, and that's looking at the average from before the pandemic. Obviously, the pandemic changed a lot of things, especially in the early years in terms of eviction filings. But so it looks like now that things are kind of back to quote unquote normal, evictions are actually trending up in Hamilton County.
And do evictions happen because people can't pay? I mean, is that why you get evicted, or are there other reasons?
The majority are lack of payment. But of course, there are other reasons that evictions are filed in Hamilton County. This number is looking at the all evictions, so filed for any reason. But the majority of those are lack of payment.
During the COVID years, for lack of a better way to describe it, there were a number of moratoriums in place. Is that right? So those numbers were going to be a little bit lower because people were not allowed to evict people then. Is that right?
That's right. Now, the status of the moratoriums in Hamilton County was a little bit back and forth because there was some, local judges choosing not to enforce the moratorium. However, evictions did go way down in the early pandemic years. That was a combination of moratoriums. Also, the Federal CARES Act, which was the first round of federal stimulus related to the pandemic, had a lot of rental assistance. And so even though folks were losing jobs and unable to pay, the rent was still getting paid for a lot of those folks. And so evictions weren't necessary. Funding has basically run out. So we've kind of returned to a pre-pandemic normal, which is there is still some rental assistance available, but not nearly enough to meet the need in this area.
So, and is that going to continue to go down? I mean, is that continue to dwindle, or is that consistent now? I mean,
the rental assistance?
Rental assistance, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it really depends, if this issue, there are some local efforts from both the city of Cincinnati and from Hamilton County to put local money into rental assistance to kind of supplement that and grow those programs. I think the other benefit of the COVID years was kind of using the federal stimulus as like a pilot study almost to see how effective rental assistance can be. And now that there is some kind of evidence showing how effective that can be, I think that has spurred some local officials at least into putting more funding into that, but certainly not nearly the level that we were seeing, millions of and even tens of millions of dollars over a few years into rental assistance. I think it's very unlikely we'd get back to that level.
How bad is the situation in terms of we keep hearing how hard it is to find housing, affordable housing in this community and communities around the country? And Nick, jump in too. I know you know a lot about this, but is that also part of it, that people are being forced to go into properties that are just above their means?
Yeah, or not even necessarily go into properties, but the same properties maybe they've lived in for a few years, the rents are going up there. Looking at the wage increases, wages have been increasing over the last couple of years, but not keeping up with the level of rent increases that we're seeing. So it is true that, yes, it is harder to find affordable housing. And by affordable, that could mean different things in different contexts. But, really just talking about spending 30% or less of your income, your monthly income on housing and utilities, so like rent or mortgage plus utilities. There are fewer available housing units at those prices, but also, even folks who maybe it was affordable when they started living there, but the rent's gone up every year since, and so it's just become unaffordable.
So, and Nick, you've observed some of this also, just the housing situation in general in the city. What have you discovered?
I mean, I think, yeah, we're continuing to struggle with affordability. We're having, I think, a lot more people who are cost burdened, which is kind of what we're talking about, where, the federal guideline is 30% of your income goes to rent and utilities. People are paying 40, 50 more percent. And it's not sustainable for a lot of people. And it's certainly not helpful for people who are trying to, kind of like save for a house or whatever it is they're trying to do. So I think, yeah, like affordability just continues to be this big issue that measures we're taking are chipping away at in terms of the city's response to the problem, but it's not moving very fast. Yeah.
And when you talk about cost burden, just to add on to this, someone at any income level can be cost burden. You could be making $1 million a year and spending more than half your income on housing. But not necessarily, at risk of being evicted.
Right.
So really the people, the households that are much more likely to be cost burdened are those low income and extremely low income households. So they're much more likely to be spending 50% or more of their income on housing. And if you think about, one emergency, one car breaking down, one, medical procedure, that comes up unexpected, can basically take away that rent payment for the month. And that's where this threat of eviction is really comes into play.
Is anything being done for the landlords? I know if people aren't paying, of course, the landlords suffer too if they have their own mortgages to pay. Is it being looked at on both sides, or is it looked at specifically at helping the tenants?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, rental assistance goes to landlords. It's not paid to the tenant. It's rental assistance is paying the money that is owed to the landlord. So, speaking with, local legal aid attorneys who represent low income folks who are facing eviction, they often will say, you know, we're looking out for the landlords, too. We want to get them paid. And rental assistance is one way to do that. But what can be difficult if you're facing an eviction hearing without representation, you know, let's say you have the money, you were able to, you know, it was late, but you were able to cobble it together from friends and family or get a loan or something like that. But the average eviction hearing is 45 seconds. So if you don't get a chance to say that to a judge and aren't sure the proceedings, that's where having representation can kind of intervene there and say, hey, the tenant can actually pay right now. We can give you that money. But not knowing all the legal jargon and in the process, you know, a tenant in that position without representation might get evicted anyway, even if they were able to pay at that time. So that's another thing with evictions that we hear from local attorneys is, you know, we just need folks to be able to speak up and have the representation to say, hey, actually, let's pay it now.
Didn't the study, maybe you said it and I missed it, but didn't it also say that people that do have representation just tend to do a whole lot better in these court proceedings?
Absolutely. That was not part of the eviction data from the eviction lab at Princeton University, but it's something that other studies have looked at and something we hear more anecdotally from the legal aid attorneys. Absolutely. If you have, one local study from, I think, 2 years ago or maybe a year and a half, found that tenants without an attorney in local eviction court are 84% more likely to lose their housing. It is a huge disparity.
So if somebody needs an attorney, where do they go? Do you know the answer to that?
Legal aid is the best option, but they can represent a very small fraction of the folks who are facing eviction. They represent folks not just in Hamilton County, but several counties in the tri-state. And with the number of, eviction filings in just Hamilton County, there were, 13,600 eviction filings in 2024, and legal aid was able to represent maybe 10% of that and multiply that by the number of counties. So it is very difficult. Obviously, if you can't afford to pay your rent, you're not very likely to, be able to afford an attorney. The city, not necessarily part of this article, but we've previously looked into, the city started a representation program. What Legal Aid does is they come in like when you get the eviction filing and they can take you through every step of that process. It's kind of lengthy and they can only do that with some folks. What the city is testing out is having an attorney there the day you show up for your hearing. So they don't know anything about your case until that day you show up. There's a table there and they say, we can help represent you through this hearing. That's more in the pilot stages, but that's something else the city is trying to address this.
And your story on the website will explain at least some of that as well. A couple of stories there, right?
Yes.
WVXU.org. Yep. I'm still alarmed by that figure you gave of 45 seconds for a hearing.
Yep.
45, that's less than a minute.
Yep.
They get less than a minute. All right. Thank you both for being here. Happy Friday.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I've been talking with WVXU long-form reporter Nick Swartzell and WVXU local government reporter Becca Costello. Producer of Cincinnati Edition is Selena Reeder. Technical director today is Stephen Baum. I'm Marianne Zalesnik filling in for Lucy May. Thanks for being here.